Is there a doctor in the house?
Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a bad case of loving you.
Doctor.
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 And doctor.
It's time for Advanced Medicine Monday with Dr. Rashid Batar.
I'm a doctor, not a bricklayer.
I'm a doctor, not a mechanic.
I'm a doctor, not a coal miner.
The doctor is in.
All right, Dr. Batar, I think this is the month I get to catch up with you in revolutions around the sun. And I'm feeling great. I'm feeling better than ever. Really strong. Got a couple of mountain bike rides in this weekend. And lo and behold, Super Don drops a story on us to open today. Advanced medicine. Age.
Okay.
Right? All about age. He knows I'm older than him, but technically he's older than me because he's already a grandpa. That's the way I've decided it. Age is just a number. Having a positive attitude towards growing old can reduce the risk of dementia. Once again, the power of thought. This is non-molecular reductionist reality validated in the scientific literature. I don't know what the skeptics, the atheistic skeptics, are going to do with this one, but man, I love this article.
Robert, did you say that did you refer to the article?
Yeah, absolutely. I love the article. A study found that positive age beliefs can reduce the risk of one of the most established genetic risk factors of dementia. They're talking not about drugs, not about surgery. They're talking about a positive attitude about growing old, going, man, this is fun, right? How that reduces the manifestation of dementia. And this, again, despite the fact that we would acknowledge the role of mercury, all that stuff, this is a unique kind of look into, my gosh, how much our outlook on life has an impact on our physiology, on our physical body.
Well, this comes down to the fifth toxicity, the emotional psychological aspect that I've always said has the greatest impact on cancer, and especially in cancer, but in all pathologies. And so this comes down to intention. And if your intention is in a positive direction, then by definition, your attention is going towards something positive. And so where attention goes, energy flows. So your energy is flowing towards a positive area. In fact, I think it was Andrew Carnegie who wrote the book, How to Influence People. I can't remember the exact title.
How to Win Friends and Influence People, something like that.
Yeah. How to Win Friends. That's it. Thank you. How to Win Friends and Influence People. And in there, he talks about the positive mental attitude. Napoleon Hill talks about the positive mental attitude. Now, there's a difference between having a positive mental attitude and having what we call wishful thinking. So positive mental attitude by itself is not sufficient. So having a positive outlook, I think that's great. This is like driving down the road, you're running out of gas and saying, I'm not going to run out of gas. You will run out of gas. So you have to take a positive mental attitude and add something else to it. And that's where you add action, taking action.
Yes. Yes.
And so you have a positive mental attitude along with an action, and that action now is, okay, I'm running out of gas. I got to find a gas station. I'm not going to run out of gas. I'm going to go find a gas station, get a gas, and then continue my journey.
Yeah.
So here comes to, if we take this topic and apply it to this study, so you've got the proper attitude or the appropriate attitude, the positive attitude, again, where attention goes, energy flows. So we put our attention towards something positive. And now we put action behind it. What type of action? Eating properly, exercising, getting adequate sleep, you know, relaxing, basically the nine steps. And you will live longer. There's just no two ways about it. You'll definitely live longer.
Dr. Batar, this my memories flood back to when I was 24 years of age and I met my mentor-to-be in homeopathy, and he was eating organically grown foods. And, you know, I was eating from the grocer's freezer and the fast food restaurants my whole life. And he said, you know, your liver's congested. You've got, you know, I had every allergy known to man. I had gastrointestinal distress, skin, you know, name it, skeletal condition, all of that. And I don't know that my belief changed overnight, but what he said to me somehow rung true. Something in me was resonated. And I was like, okay, what do I got to do? He says, you need to start eating organically. I'm like, okay. Now, did I necessarily believe at that moment that it would change my life for the better? I didn't know definitively that it would. This was a new concept for me, but something in me said, okay, give it a try. Maybe just humor the guy. Humor yourself. Why not? You haven't tried that. You've tried all the drugs, right? So I did that. And of course, as it kind of reinforced, I don't know if it was my belief system. It's hard to remember the detail. Did I suddenly believe? I don't know that I necessarily did, except I saw a guy that was way older than me, that was way sicker than me when he was older than me, that was alive and running circles around me. So I had to go with my own eyes. There's something to this. And so I made the switch, and I've never looked back on that except to say, my gosh, that was a great turning point in my life. But you're right. Once those beliefs changed, it wasn't like I was temporarily in the mix of organic. I never went back. I was like, this means too much to me and my body. I have been through another pathway, and I suffered because of it. I don't want to go back. Then I see the relationship. So it changed what I did. My behavior shifted because my beliefs did indeed change.
Yeah, I think that, you know, your experience, Robert, is probably not as widely experienced as you would think, even though common sense would dictate that more people would experience what you have experienced and then follow the same steps. But I think people start to eat from an emotional basis. They may not be regimented. I know myself, I'm pretty regimented in everything I do, but food is the one place that's the exception. Everything else is very regimented, from exercise, you know, all the different things that I do, self-discipline aspects, you know, how I work, all the different things in life, they're pretty well regimented. But food is my vice. I think that would be one of my difficult things to restrain. I just love to eat.
And listen, so I love to eat, but I load up on the organic junk food from time to time. I can't wait to work my next visit to Phoenix because there's an organic pizza place. Man, I'm going to pig out. Although I end up eating the Indian food there, weirdly enough, but that's just me.
Yeah, well, I mean, the food, you know, food is a great thing. And so I think that it depends also when people find out that certain things that do make them feel ill, whether it's an allergy type sensation or whether it's a digestive issue or whether it's sometimes it can manifest itself as a delayed IgG mediated food allergy, so that people will experience arthralgias, you know, like joint aches, or they'll experience headaches. And actually, if you think about it, in a way, the types of food that cause these reactions, it's actually a blessing that the Creator gives us this feedback where our bodies react in a manner that's adversarial to the food that we're consuming. But when we look at that food, we realize that the symptom that we're experiencing is actually, yes, uncomfortable, but the damage that the food would do to us is far greater. And that if we allow the feedback to regulate our behavior by not ingesting these foods that are causing these untoward effects, it's actually going to benefit our health in the longer, from a longer basis. I mean, in other words, it's almost like the little rattling in the engine is warning you that the engine can blow up if you don't stop doing. But
the doctors enabled my poor choices and the choices my parents made for me because they didn't know either, because there wasn't an emphasis on real eating, real food, whole, fresh, organic food, obviously. It was about, hey, the kid's got symptoms. Let's give them some drugs. And boy, did I get lots of drugs and shots and all of that. And I had skeletal weakness. I remember having tendonitis as a kid, and that's why I took up swimming, because I couldn't do the gravity, you know, impact stuff. And then, of course, years later, I took up boxing. I couldn't do that when I was a kid. And now, you know, taking this intense mountain biking to the next level. And it's just like we talk about the story about aging, opening the story about aging. It's like positive attitude. I feel pretty good. You know, I mean, sure, a Mack truck could take you out at any time, but in terms of the chronicity of the degradation, I'm not experienced degradation. In fact, some of the opposite is what I'm experiencing, and I gain a lot from this article kind of strengthening, again, what you've talked about, the fifth toxicity as well.
Right. So this is one of the things that if people recognize the emotional aspect in everything that we do, and especially in food, you know, there have been many studies that have been done to show that people eat at specific times of the day. People eat during specific emotional states. Some people eat when they're lonely. Some people eat when they're depressed, more so than they would at other times. Other times, those same people, if they're in a high level of excitement and joy, they may forget to eat. So I think that mood has a lot to do with it. Also, different parts of the world where there's more cloud cover, not as much sun, They will have done studies to see, does the state of mind have anything to do with the propensity for obesity and such. I don't think those have shown as much conclusion as the studies showing the emotional state of an individual and when they tend to eat more. But especially in the evenings, we tend to eat more. Then, of course, you've got issues with types of foods too, sweet versus the savory foods. If a person is under adrenal exhaustion, they're going to have a desire for more of the chips and the salty types of foods, which are going to have a problem with the trans fats and some of these other types of detrimental components. And people that are necessarily don't have the adrenal issue, they'll have a tendency for sweets. So now you're driving the hyperinsulinemic type response. And so that will also lead to obesity. So you've got cortisol on one side, and you've got insulin response on the other side, both of them leading to chronic obesity. So it comes down to various aspects where emotional states can have a tremendous impact on the choices that people make, and as not only the choices of foods that they're intaking, but the types of foods, categories of foods, and it's really a biological, physiological response that's driving them. And once you become aware of that, that's half the battle. Mm-hmm. And you can start taking steps that are necessary to alleviate those physiological constraints and then hopefully overcome
Sometimes, Dr. Bittar, the physical restraints, or let's say responses, have to be so severe to overwhelm our emotional reluctance to leave a certain pattern of behavior. Would you agree?
Yeah,
I mean, for me, I was miserable enough physically that I said, you know what, I don't care what emotional attachment I have to the kind of foods, I've got to make a change. Now, I will eat some of those foods I ate as a child, but the organic versions of them. Do you follow me? I haven't, kind of abandoned 100% of the things I grew up with, but cleaner versions. And I've still, for the most part, benefited from that. And no, I'm not a vegetarian. I have been, and I listen to my body. If my body needs, you know, I can subsist that way. Or either, but like I said, it's sensitivity to your cells. What are they calling for? And I was not in a position to understand the language of my body because the doctors taught me to ignore it by taking a drug, taking out the warning light, et cetera, and saying, yep, your engine's just fine now. You see, the symptom's gone.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I totally agree with you, Robert. I think that there's so many different aspects to this, and there are books that are actually that I've read personally, and I'm trying to remember the title of one particular one I read about 5 years ago, 6 years ago. But there's some books that are also written about these subjects that I love this topic.
I love this topic. The other aspect of aging, mission, purpose. If you have a mission, if you're a purpose-driven, you know, human souls, you're enjoying being here. You'll find a way to find enjoyment even in the difficulties of the occasional times when Super Don just kind of lets it loose like last hour. He's going, this is crazy. But we're having a good time with Dr. Rasha Bittar. Check out medicalrewind.com, advancedmedicine.com, and we'll be right back.
The revolution will be broadcast.
The Robert Scott Bell Show. Making sense out of medical propaganda. Here's Robert.
Okay, let's see. Where do we go? We got a lot of cool stories here in the show notes at robertscottbell.com. Remember, archives available at iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, UK Health Radio, SoundCloud, right here on YouTube, RSBell Media Channel, and of course our home and broadcast radio syndication, GCN, GCNlive.com. 2 hours a day, 6 days a week, a very special hour, Advanced Medicine with Dr. Bittar. Again, Medical Rewind as well as AdvancedMedicine.com, also great sites for you to go to keep up with all that we are doing. We got a shorter segment here. I'm debating whether we dive into the question of the day with Ken, but you know, have you ever had patients, younger patients, with juvenile arthritis or systemic sclerosis, Dr. Bittar?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, in the 9-step book, one of the chapters, I start out by talking about the story of, what was her name? I can't even remember now her name. In the book, Morgan. Morgan. The story of Morgan. You remember that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I've got the book right over my shoulder. Yeah. I want everybody, the 9 steps to keep the doctor away. And Ken, who asked this question, if you haven't picked that up, it's available on Amazon and all over the place, many different languages. So what do you see? Anything unusual or different than the things we always talk about? Terrain. We clear the terrain. We give the body what it needs. Are there unique nuances to a patient that manifests something like that?
Yes, they are. So You've already mentioned the first aspect, terrain. So, and I've actually just happened to have a copy of the book in front of me, mm-hmm. and I'm trying to see which chapter it was, the story of Morgan. But I believe we start off, it's in the principle of nutrition. And, okay, yeah. It's in early on in the book, but the story of Morgan basically talks about a young girl that was brought to me with juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. She had been on many extensive drug regimens, including steroids. She was on Plaquenil, which is a chemotherapeutic agent. She was on methotrexate, which is a steroid. She was on gold. She'd had multiple surgeries. And so juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, in a nutshell, you already said it, Robert, terrain. So we started off with her gut. Her gut was really off. Had to get her gut straight. She had heavy metals, had to get her heavy metals straight. Nutritionally, had to get her balanced minerals. And lo and behold, within a few months, she started having an increase in range of motion, and the rest is history. But it's a pretty dramatic story about this young girl and how she was actually scheduled for another major surgery. The big thing about her was that with all the drugs that she was on, I knew that she was going to go into kidney failure by the time she was 10, 12, 14 years old. She was, I think she was 4 or 5 when she came to us. So now she's in her mid-20s. She's a year older than my daughter, so she's 25. Ended up playing sports in college. You know, beautiful young lady. But it was interesting that her, at least, you know, per her parents, and actually myself also having known what her medical history was, she would have had a totally different life had she would have probably ended up having kidney failure, early kidney failure, maybe even necessitating dialysis by the time she was in her teens, or definitely by her early 20s, just because those drugs that she was on were going to just ruin her kidneys. So terrain is the first thing, gut, heavy metals, toxic load. So if you look at this as a general aspect for all disease, one, remove the things that shouldn't be there, the toxicities. Two, replace what the body needs with what it should have, i.e. the nutrients, values, the minerals, vitamins, et cetera, whatever it is. And then make sure that you deal with the terrain issue, which is, again, look at the gastrointestinal system. The organs of detoxification is where my focus is. This is where the HEDMAP comes in, the Advanced Health Evaluation Assessment for Detoxification Medical Assessment Program. So the kidneys, the liver, the gastrointestinal system, the skin, and those are the four major organs of detoxification that I look at. And of course, there are other aspects to this too. Your lungs are an area, an organ of detoxification, and there's the lymphatics, et cetera, et cetera. But if you can just focus on the liver, the kidneys, the gut, and skin, you're going to be way, way, way ahead compared to most people.
Dr. Bitar, I can't tell you how often I have to repeat this same message, as do you. I was talking to a lady off the air earlier today about that she had been on all these different medications for Lyme disease and chronic fatigue, and she's trying to figure it out. And, you know, I'm asking her what she's done, and she's on so many different pills, supplements now, non-drugs, but most of them are synthetic, and they're not really getting in. So I'm like, you want something to get in, give the body something that even knows what it is, right? Even though you say it, as we talk about the difference between real or natural and not natural, and we talk about the synthetic amino acids once again in terms of intravenous chelation, to reduce a mercury burden, a heavy metal burden in an unnatural sense, but a very efficient and effective means where sometimes you can't get it any other way, get at it any other way. All right, we got a lot more healing to go. We're going to talk about ultrasounds and autism. Is there a link? And the Geyers won a big lawsuit against the medical board.
The Robert Scott Bell Show.
In all my years of radio, I've never seen anything like this.
The Robert Scott Bell Show. Robert Scott Bell Show.
Robert Scott Bell Show.
All right, for those of you who have been listening to Advanced Medicine right here on the Robert Scott Bell Show with Dr. Rasha Bitar, for years and years, you know the story, how it began, and it's in the book we referenced last segment, the international best-selling book, The 9 Steps to Keep the Doctor Away. Now I get $10 from Dr. Bitar. I mentioned it twice.
And listen,
his story of his son getting harmed by vaccines into the autism spectrum, and the prayers to God that says, God, if you help me to get my son well, I will dedicate my life to this. This is a Dr. Bitar story that keeps on being told and has to be told again and again and again. So the story of autism is not over, because unfortunately, the vast majority of doctors are still pro-vaccine as it stands today, still injecting. And of course, we know that in government and in media, they're all falling still in lockstep with this issue and paying no attention to the adverse events that follow it. Now, it isn't that we're saying there's only one cause. It's a preponderance of a lot of things, but oftentimes the vaccines and what they contain are the straw that breaks the camel's back, so to speak, and the mercury being the biggest issue. But there's an article here about ultrasounds potentially contributing to autism. And I want to know, Dr. Pattar, is that, I mean, it wasn't ever high on my list as far as advanced imaging technology, that ultrasounds were like as bad as ionizing radiation. But there has been controversy saying, hey, there are problems there with that, too.
Well, I think, Robert, this is a perfect example of causing distraction. So this is, you know, a decoy type thing. Let's mm-hmm. talk about ultrasound and create a distraction from the real issues, which are the toxic substances like mercury that causes denudation of the neurofibrils and the radiating ionizing type energetic therapeutics or energetic
diagnostics
like MRIs, PET scans, CAT scans, that type of stuff. So could it contribute? It certainly could. But why are we talking about, or why are we worried about the drop in a bucket when we've got a torrential rainstorm coming down upon us with these other toxic substances? So whether or not ultrasound has a contribution to this, I really don't know. But I can tell you this. I have never tried to undo the effects of an ultrasound and reverse a case of autism. But we've got a few thousand cases of children that we've removed the mercury from, and their neurocognitive abilities come back. So I, again, think this is one of those cases of talking about something that really has no relevance and they're just trying to cause a distraction.
Right, acknowledging that there may be a role, but my gosh, is it a drop in the bucket relative to what the biggest issue is? And, of course, yeah, they'll be happy to allow you to speak about that as a potential cause, but my gosh, if you try to publish that mercury or vaccines have anything to do with it, it will be shouted down, you'll be ridiculed, you'll be wakefielded, et cetera.
They won't even let you publish it. It will never even be printed. So that's interesting that they'll print stuff like this, but as soon as something, it mentions autism and mercury in the same paper, it'll never get published. Dr. Robin Bernhoff and I had a paper that we had submitted, and it was a very, very well-encompassing type of paper with 171 references, and we made the fatal mistake of mentioning mercury and autism in the paper. And he even went back and tried to change some of the things I'd written. He said, you know, let's not be so definitive. Let's say, you know, may contribute to, and we change it. But we submitted that night, and the next morning, like within like 6 hours of us submitting it from California time, he submitted at 9 o'clock California time, which is midnight East Coast time, and 8 o'clock East Coast time. We had the paper back, the peer review process of three physicians having reviewed it, came back and said that your paper does not meet the criteria for publication. I mean, who on a Sunday night actually reviewed, which three peer-reviewed journal members actually reviewed this paper for JAMA? You know, it was an electronic scan that was checking for keywords.
Yeah, a sham and a scam all at once in terms of peer review. Now, we move on to Mark and David Geyer, who you know very well. I know very well. I've met them through Autism One and had them on the show. And they're nice. They're nice people. They're intense. They're researchers. The dad is a medical doctor as well. And, you know, they recognize the danger of mercury. They also talked about the susceptibility and vulnerability of boys versus girls and posited the hormonal aspect of testosterone enhancing the impact of mercury and estrogen perhaps protecting the girls. And again, whether that's fully valid or not, maybe you could speak to that more. But he began to utilize a drug called Lupron that somehow suppressed testosterone or something and, of course, was ridiculed, marginalized, etc. And now it wasn't just about them not liking what he did, the establishment not liking what Dr. Geyer did. But they went after him and trashed him in the media, dragged his name through the mud. And he has now won, I think, $1.5 million lawsuit against the Maryland Board of Physicians. Because it wasn't about findings of fact. Or how much was it?
$2.5 million. But what's interesting is that the judge, when I just read it with the, by the way, I did not get the nice little elevator music sound back.
Sorry, we were talking while you were reading.
Right, but it was actually of the $2.5 million in a very rare show. They said the judge also said that half of that money had to come from the personal pockets of the members of the Board of Physicians, which is amazing. $10,000 to $200,000, depending on the net worth. So $1.25 million had to come from the personal pockets of the people that were on the board, which is awesome because that actually now sets a precedent that members of the medical board cannot be cannot hide behind their. That's right. Can't be shielded. Exactly.
You're right. This is huge. And this puts them on notice because, listen, all the stories about we've talked about your history, the attacks on you, how much you defended yourself and came through it. But I don't know there was precedent at that point where you could sue the board and then nail the actual physicians on the board. And the judge was so outraged with their egregious behavior and attacks to discredit the Geyers and destroy their careers and their reputations to such a degree that they would, you know, rule in the favor of the Geyers and, again, rule against those physicians, not just as the board where they'd be covered by insurance, but they have to come out of their own pocket, which, again, tells me the tide is a bit turning here.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Exactly right, and I think it's high time that this happened. It's actually very interesting, the timing of this. And I think that, Robert, what you and I talked about off the air, which we won't go into detail now, but I think this is a perfect example of something that...
Yeah, a little pushback.
Exactly.
Yeah, like, look at here. You like this? You like this roadmap? I see this coming in your future, right? You know, dangle it in front of these boards of medicine before they act and react the way they have in the past. Now, do you want to make any commentary on that whole Lupron thing? Because I'm not a big fan of manipulating hormones because I do believe that the mercury issue, getting it out, is more primary than I understand the concept, the principle, maybe the theory behind what they did, but it wasn't something I was like really excited about.
I'm of the same exact thought process. I do not believe it's a intelligent way of dealing with this because you're dealing with a young patient population, testosterone levels are being prevented. Basically, Lupron is a luteinizing hormone inhibitor and basically prevents the formation of testosterone and some of the precursors basically, Lupron prevents formation of testosterone. And so when you deal with that in a child that is prepubescent or even pubescent, the problem is you are going to inhibit their
development, normal,
their eventual hormone and endocrine adrenal axis. So you're going to prevent them from actually having full maturation of the musculoskeletal system. You know, you will have the epiphyseal plates will not fully close. You're going to have all sorts of other. It's basically sterilizing or like doing an orchiectomy, you know, a castration. So it's a chemical castration.
Yeah. So again, I get the concept why they came up with a thought form, but again, why they went that way. Yeah.
Let's talk about that for a second. So basically what they found was that estrogen had a protective effect. So they found the incidence of autism 4 times greater in boys than men, and they attributed that to the testosterone because estrogen seemed to have a protective effect in boys because if they have a higher testosterone content and lower estrogen content, its incidence is 4 times higher. So they also found that antibiotics also accelerated and caused incidence of autism 4 times higher. So what they thought, the postulate was, okay, let's inhibit the testosterone production by giving something that blocks testosterone, thus increasing the estrogen ratio and thus decreasing the incidence of autism. So again, I don't think this is the right way of doing it. This is like kind of saying every time the sea fire engines, I see fire engines, I see fires, therefore I conclude the fires cause fire engines.
Right,
fire.
Right.
You know, it's one of those mentalities. You don't remove, you first put the fire out before you rebuild the house. And this is like they're trying to rebuild a house
without putting the fire out, right? And the thing is, they knew about, this is not us bashing and trashing the guy. I think they're very intelligent and they have integrity. They're sincere in their efforts to help people.
Oh, absolutely. Without a doubt.
So it's just a matter of discussing fundamentals in how we would look at it and go about it differently. Not that they're necessarily wrong in that that acknowledgement. But again, why, like, I don't know. But, you know, you went to the heart of it and said, you know, we got to get the mercury out. We got to get the heavy metals out. And that was primary. And then
They actually were using our protocol, the transdermal DMPS, too, because they agreed with the mercury aspect. I mean, when I said it wasn't intelligent, I meant physiologically it is not an intelligent way. Because I don't think anything, when you start to manipulate the human physiology or the physiological machinery that the ultimate engineer created, I don't think that's smart to mess with Mother Nature.
Right. Yeah, exactly. We want to get the things that are blocking normal function, optimal function out of the way. And again, though, at this point, though, the fact that the Board of Physicians went after them to destroy them, it wasn't enough that whatever happened, if they lost their life, whatever it was initially, but to go beyond that, now there's accountability and there's a warning being placed on all of these people serving in these positions on state boards of medicine, right? Licensing boards. And I think this is a good thing so that they can limit their action to something very specific. They go beyond it. Now they're liable. And now there might be some repercussions in terms of their behavior.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Robert. I think that this is something that has long been overdue, and
God willing, will set a precedent.
Mm-hmm. That's a beautiful thing. Now, moving on to epigenetics, and this maybe carries us through the rest of the show. I almost think this is, a redundant thing to say? Epigenetic study reveals environmental influences can change gene behavior. I mean, you're studying something that is validating what you're studying. I don't know. I mean, I don't have a problem with it, except that it seems like the headline could have been better. But basically, you're validating the concept that environment impacts gene expression.
Which is exactly what we have been talking about for many, many years. This is Bruce Lipton's work. Mm-hmm. The genetic expression is dependent upon the environmental trigger. And the fact that it's now a study that's come out, two decades after Lipton's book, and God knows how many decades after other people have said this. It's interesting, but anyway, it's
one of those ridiculous things. Yeah, and I want to parse this again. We're going to come back. We'll look at this a little bit more on the break, Dr. Bitar, but somehow they're talking specifically pregnancy-inducing epigenetic changes, which, again, seems to be a moment of doubt, but maybe there's something we're missing here that is beyond obvious, that is subtle. I want to look into that and find out, because I love the topic of epigenetics and really destroying that concept of genetic determinism once and for all, to recognize that, like I changed at the age of 24, you can change at the age of 48. At whatever age you met, you can change your future. Talk about graceful aging. You look at it differently. You view it differently. You engage it with excitement and humor as well. And you're going to get through it with us right here on the Robert Scott Bell Show. More advanced medicine and Dr. Bitar next.
Great heavens, what kind of radio show is this?
The Robert Scott Bell Show. Willing to go where the truth takes him, here's Robert.
Taking us to Epigenetic Street. Right now, as we follow up on this article in the show notes at robertscatbell.com, remember, if you miss a show, particularly when we're on with Dr. Bitar doing advanced medicine, we got medicalrewind.com, thousands of hours now. In fact, it's a lot. And advancedmedicine.com, also a great place to go. Robertscatbell.com as well. Now, Dr. Bitar, we were reviewing this a little bit off the air, talking to our folks that are watching us on YouTube. And it's an epigenetic study, which we love, and I'm glad there's more of that going on. But is it enough? I guess when you publish them, it's enough to just observe something and not make an explanation for it, right? Because as they talk about the changes of women going through pregnancy, and they say, wow, epigenetic shifts, there's not one mention of depletion of minerals in the process of producing a baby and replenishing them to break that cycle of what they say are increased likelihood of certain diseases after pregnancy. Well, who doesn't know that nutritionally?
Yeah, so this definitely could be a moment of duh. I think this is where you should be playing that music. But, any time that you have in any species, the female of those species carry a, from the time egg is fertilized, forms a zygote, and then replicates and forms an embryo, and eventually fetus is developed, and then baby is delivered. That whole period of gestation, whatever that period is, that is an extremely traumatic period of time from a nutritional basis, at least for that mother, because her entire system goes into a mode of providing nutrients for that baby at the cost of herself. So you will see bone mass density decreasing. You will see nutrient depletions. You'll see mineral issues that will become very evident. And, you can see this just from the behaviors of the nausea that affects them, the preeclampsia, some of these things. Preeclampsia actually is a magnesium deficiency. You can give an individual magnesium and help that. But this is, again, a massive, massive nutrient dumping from the mother to the fetus. So it doesn't make any sense why anybody would be surprised with the fact that it's going to cause some type of a disruption in the mother. Mm-hmm. And to say that it's an epigenetic issue with the environmental triggers exposing or environmental trigger causing a expression of the genes to manifest a certain way, that's just, of course, that's common sense. It's like, you take a deep breath in, you're going to live, and if you stop breathing, you're going to die type of thing. I don't understand the point of it, but again,
this has long been identified in terms of nutritional deficiency. You know, whether we go back in time to look at the most obvious deficiencies, the berries of the world, and you go, wait, couldn't that be argued epigenetics? Because without, you know, particular vitamins, minerals, whatever it is that you associate with a quote-unquote disease manifestation, you alter the terrain by giving the terrain something that rebalances it, and then what grows there, oh my gosh, it's healthy again, right? The concept in organic farming, biodynamic farming, same thing. If the soil is imbalanced, that light, those life forms that grow in that soil will also be imbalanced and then somewhat vulnerable, for instance, to pest infestation. We might call that in human terms a cancer, right? Something's eating itself from within, much less the bugs that might be attracted to it that it's vulnerable to as well. And, you know, the organic farmers know this long before it was called epigenetics.
Yeah, but the thing is that, you know, you're talking an imbalance. I'm not even talking about an imbalance aspect here. This is just everything is being depleted. You know, a balance issue means that one mineral or vitamin or some substance is in a different ratio to the rest, in reference to the rest of the vitamins and minerals or whatever other substances we're talking about. So there's a disruption in the balance. But when you're talking about a woman that's pregnant or any animal that's pregnant carrying a fetus to term, there's a reduction. It's not an imbalance. Sure, there's imbalances that can result, but it is a depletion. It's like a bucket that's full.
You're talking across the board, then.
Across the board, yeah. It's just depletion, depletion, depletion. And so, of course, that's going to cause a disruption. And so the moment of dough to me is very obvious with this particular one. Mm-hmm. Of course, imbalances can result too. But when you've got it's almost like a boat that has a leak in it. The boat's going to sink type of thing, right? And this is the reason that it's so important for mothers to be supplementing with multivitamins and folic acid, all the stuff, because many of these minerals and vitamins that a mother needs, if the fetus doesn't have them in sufficient quantity, can cause an anomaly in the birth defect.
Sure, right. The folate form is they've proven to be the form that actually is manifesting, the betterment, for instance, of the protection of the child. We talk about all of these minerals being depleted as well. But Dr. Batar, man, another great ride through advanced medicine, my friend. So much, so much fun. And I think Super Don even calmed down during this hour just a wee bit. So
he did.
Maybe you can tell them what they need to know, because it's time to go.
The power to heal is unequivocally yours.
Yeah, baby.
The Robert Scott Bell Show.